This is Public. This is a podcast about cities, people and place, produced by Open House Melbourne. This is Emma Telfer.
And this is Sally McPhee. We live in Melbourne, Australia, and we love our city.
We've been friends for years, but come from kind of different careers.
But recently, we've started working together on public programs about the city.
We saw the opportunity for documenting, sharing, and making more public the content and ideas of our work.
And these same projects also bring together thinkers, doers, and advocates
who are shaping our city. To be public is to be shared. So this is us, sharing some of the stories, ideas, and issues consuming our thoughts via a podcast. All made possible by the Metro Tunnel Creative Program. A program dedicated to enhancing city life alongside the construction of the Metro Tunnel.
Welcome to This is Public. The question of what kind of city we want cannot be divorced from the question of what kind of people we want to be, what kinds of social relations we seek, what relations to nature we cherish, what style of daily life we desire, what kinds of technologies we deem appropriate, what aesthetic values we hold. The right to the city is, therefore, far more than a right of individual access to the resources that the city embodies. It is a right to change ourselves by changing the city more after our heart's desire. It is a collective rather than an individual right, since changing the city inevitably depends upon the exercise of a collective power over the processes of urbanisation. The freedom to make and remake ourselves and our cities is one of the most precious, yet most neglected, of our human rights. That's from the introduction to geographer and urban theorist David Harvey's influential essay from 2003, The Right to the City. And those words provide a fitting introduction to this, episode 4 of This is Public, which we've called The Rights to the City. We're exploring that idea in relation to the rights of people with disabilities to access and change the city, and the role design plays in creating a truly accessible urban environment. Emma, hello.
Hi, Sally.
Emma, this comes off the back of the July program for Open House Melbourne.
Yes, our July program includes obviously the much-loved Open House weekend, but we've really grown the public program offer over the past few years, taken over the whole month of July. And we always pick a theme to build the program around. And this year it was the rights to the city. So as part of the July program, Open House presented Urban Tactility, which included a series of talks, discussions and tours centered around a fully realized installation of a project also called Urban Tactility. We supported Urban Tactility through its inception and development, and we were able to push and prod at ideas around rights to the city in a number of different ways. We interrogated, how does the city support or isolate people who are living with disability? We also had a public program of conversations, which really considered the rights to the city from a broader perspective. We were asking the question about, what does a truly accessible city look like? And what do we need to do to get there in the future? What are the current challenges? What are we doing well? What are we not doing so well? And there's many things that we're not doing so well at the moment.
Lots of different experiences and voices heard through those discussions, from artists living with disabilities to examples of design processes that were true collaborations. But what came through really strongly for me is the agency of people living with a disability and how it's incumbent on designers who aren't or aren't yet living with disability to think deeply about this, which is something we explored in the last episode, the idea of how important it is to think outside your own experience and seek input from others. And I thought that that really came through strongly in the July program, and we'll go into that more today.
So in this episode, we talked to the team behind the Urban Tactility installation, Tanya Davidge and Christine Phillips from OOPLA. We also speak with Janice Florence from Arts Access and Weave Movement Theatre, who is a guest at the Rights to the City talk and who also popped into the SB studio for a chat.
But first, I want to talk about an idea that was actually introduced during the Rights to the City talk. That talk included artist Faye and V. And this idea I thought was such a beautiful and simple concept. And it was the idea of access intimacy.
Yes, such a great concept. Disability justice activist, writer and educator Mia Mingus coined the term to describe the intimacy that occurs when people just get the access needs of people with disabilities. and who do their best to alleviate what is known as access labour for their friends or family who may be living with a disability. A simple outing can actually mean a lot of work for people living with disabilities, and we know that talking to Janice when she came to the SB. We had to do a lot of pre-planning, she had to do a lot of pre-planning, just even around car parking, access to the curb, getting into the building, getting into the podcast studio, making sure her wheelchair would fit in, what kind of wheelchair she would bring. So it was really eye-opening in terms of the hours of labour that she put in into coming to see us, and we really cherished the fact that she did.
And access intimacy could also be used to describe the work of Seiichi Miyake, a Japanese inventor who, when his friend was losing his vision in 1965, designed and built something that would go on to change the streets of our cities for people with low vision forever. Inspired to help a friend, Seiichi Miyake designed and made floor mats which, through the use of raised dots and shapes, indicated in a tactile way danger to someone with low vision and guided them towards a safer route. The bumps, lines and dots in the mats could be felt underfoot or by a cane, and the design went on to be adopted, adapted and incorporated into accessibility codes in countries all around the world, including Australia, where you'll find them in many of our public buildings and on our city streets. They're called tactile indicators.
Tanya Davich and Christine Phillips are Melbourne architects, artists, academics and activists who've worked with tactile indicators in traditional and experimental ways as OOPLA, and we invited them in to the SB to talk about empathy and design and their connections to the right to the city concept. We started off by asking them to explain the name OOPLA.
We're really interested in engaging people, and we do this through play. So the PL of play is Office of Playful Architecture. We're interested in the public, so it's Office of Public Architecture, and we're interested in advocacy and the political, so it's the Office of Political Architecture. What we bring to the non-traditional spatial projects that we deal with is a very architectural way of looking at things. So while we might not be practicing architecture anymore as traditional architects, we both look through very architectural lenses. My name's Tanya Davich. I'm writing a PhD on how we communicate the built environment to public audiences at the University of Melbourne. I'm also a community activist, most notably last year for running the campaign to stop the Apple Store at Federation Square. I collaborate with Christine and we work on these projects together. We've known each other for a very long time and the collaboration is quite strong because of this public interest that we have.
My name's Christine Phillips. I am an architect. I'm also on the Heritage Council of Victoria. I'm a full-time lecturer at RMIT and I studied architecture at RMIT way back in the 90s with Tanya Davich, so that's how we got to know each other. I do a bit of writing and I do projects with Tanya through our practice OOPLA. We both have worked in practice on buildings. I've worked in a number of small to large practices over the years before I became a full-time academic, and I found that I really loved working on the public buildings more than, say, private residential commissions. So I think that interest in the public was always there. I think what's brought Tanya and I together is we both have an interest in the public realm and how architecture contributes to our lives and how we experience our cities.
Urban Tactility was a playful installation in the courtyard of Melbourne's Immigration Museum made up of thousands of tactile indicators. What inspired two sighted women with an architecture background to create a public installation using these design features?
Tactile indicators are the raised dots and lines that you see on a pavement, typically at pedestrian intersections, for example. They're there to kind of mark in a haptic way, like in a tactile way, hence tactile indicators, a hazard or a place to stop. So the lines will lead you in places when you see the linear ones, and the dots usually mark a point of stopping or a change in threshold. And I was on holiday, oh my God, it might have been 4 years ago now, and we were in Oslo at Snøhetta's beautiful opera house. But what my children found really interesting at this space was there were these beautiful bronze tactile indicators along the ground leading to the front doors. And so they started to ask me questions about them. What were they? What were they doing? And I explained what they were for. And then they both closed their eyes and we walked them along this line so they could feel them with their feet. That was kind of the start of the inspiration for some of the project. And then another side of the project is the idea that we can use, you know, a kind of spatial art, public art installation to provoke conversations around different audiences in the city. So how might you use the city if you have low vision or blindness? How can you kind of walk in somebody else's shoes for a time? How do we actually then start to connect different communities and have empathy for what different people in the city need and require, and how do we make the city accessible?
We had a lot of conversations about how we navigate our cities, and we started to think about tactile indicators and how they're a sort of a wayfinding device and how we might be able to tap into those in a very playful way and reinterpret them for people who are sighted, people with low vision, as a way to draw attention to the spaces around us and just stop for a moment, turn our phones off, listen to the sounds, pay attention to the smells, all these wonderful things that make up the city fabric, and the things that we just often forget about on our daily journeys to work or wherever we're going. So we've redesigned a tactile indicator in a very playful, colourful way. So they're a bit larger than your standard ones that you'll find on the street. There's three different colours. There's yellow ones, there's blue ones, and there's pink ones. We worked with the outside space at the Immigration Museum, and we spent a lot of time there thinking about the nature of the space and how it tells a lot of stories about immigration and how immigrants arrived to Australia. So we thought, okay, well, how might we draw on these very everyday urban fabric items and use them as a wayfinding device to draw attention to the spaces at the Immigration Museum?
We laid down at least 3,500 custom-made tactile indicators that take you on this journey, but they describe different things in the courtyard. So in the paving, there is the traces laid out in a kind of a timber inlay of old buildings that used to sit in that courtyard. And so the line of the tactiles follows that line. There are commemorative walls around three edges of the courtyard, and on engraved stainless steel plaques on the walls are the names of people who've migrated to Australia. The tactiles then lead you up the ramp, and you can feel these walls. In the upper courtyard, the tactiles take you towards seating and you can sit and have a rest. They take you towards the beautiful water feature, raised bronze plaques with raised names on them, and the water kind of flows over them. So the idea is that you can also listen to the sounds of the courtyard.
Participants in the Urban Tactility installation and Sensory City Tours were invited to cover their eyes with a scarf or wear special goggles supplied by program partner Vision Australia. These goggles were designed to simulate low vision conditions like tunnel vision, macular degeneration, or cataracts. With the partner as your guide, you explored the space using the tactile indicators as a wayfinding device. Bronwyn Scott, orientation and mobility expert from Vision Australia, gave guidance to participants on what they might feel, hear, or experience in the space, and how to be a good-sighted companion for your partner. We visited the installation with their audio editor, Chris Andrews, as our guide.
Some of the things we might look for too are things like these metal brakes and things where you've got a change of foot, so you know, when I get to that, that means I'm at this point. Then I look for my next landmark for that maybe. It might be underfoot or it might be some other thing that we need.
It's so... so loud, the sound of the construction.
Is it? It's just, it doesn't even sound that loud to me. Super senses. What I'll get you to do is I'll just hold this.
Yeah.
Because there's a rail on your right hand side.
Okay.
Show.
And then just be one thing to be aware of on here is that the rail on here actually stops before the edge of the stairs.
That's a
good
tip.
So it's really tricky, and that's one of the things about design that can be make a big difference, because the rails are meant to go
until
the
edge.
Yeah. And when you're gliding, you just stay one step in front so that they can, again, your partner can feel the body.
You feel it as I go down?
Yeah, and just let them know when they're at the bottom.
Very good.
That's good.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting that you both don't really work on buildings. You're not traditional architects in that sense.
The architectural profession is wonderful, and it delivers buildings in a particular way, in a structured way. But I think there are things that you can say in an art context and in a really engaging way that you can't necessarily say in the confines of other contexts. I think we find that these kind of spatial installations are a really powerful way to do that, because we're not looking at the same audience we're looking at as professional architects. We're looking at trying to reach a broader audience, we're trying to reach an undefined audience, we're trying to engage them with the city. And so it's a different thing, and it's a different mode of attention and concentration that's required. And so it's trying to bring something into a space that allows that attention to kind of be grabbed and held, even if it's just for, you know, an hour or something.
As a professional architect, you're not usually engaged in the practice of making a building. There's a whole team of construction people that do that. So there's something about the act of making and being part of that process and the conversations that occur when you're actually constructing these installations is really lovely. We were down at the Immigration Museum and there were tons of school kids around, and already the conversations were starting about, oh, they're those dots that blind people use. And just hearing those conversations was, you know, really inspiring, exactly what we're hoping for.
Urban tactility and the July program's overall theme, The Rights to the City, were designed to prompt audiences to consider the experience of other people, for people not living with a disability to take the perspective of those who are, and for all of us to discuss the ways in which our city is and isn't accessible or inclusive, and how we can change that.
Often when we go into the city and we lead busy lives, we think that the moment that we are in time is fixed, but it's not. We all go through different stages where we need different things. One of the interesting things about Vision Australia's client base is that the area that's expanding in is in the more elderly, because what's happening obviously is we're all living longer lives, and so to have an understanding of what is required, or to try to gain an understanding of what is required as we age and as different challenges present themselves to us, I think can only make us better designers and hopefully better citizens if you're not, you know, if you're experiencing the project not as a designer.
For people to just actually think about the city in a different way, and how people with low vision or are blind might experience the city, I think, you know, is a step in the right direction to moving towards a more inclusive city. And while we do have all these codes and regulations, I think there are some issues with our city, and it's not entirely an inclusive city like I would like it to be.
I think it's part of a broader conversation that we're starting to understand is really important. The city of Vienna about 10 years ago started to look at how people actually used their cities, and they found that what their planners were doing was they were planning for a certain kind of person, a very homogenous kind of person who used the city. So that person was typically male, but, you know, it was also the office worker. You go into the city, you go to work, you come down for lunch, and you go back to your office, and then you go home. What they actually found was that people actually do many, many more complicated things in the city than that, often women. But, you know, and so women's journeys typically involved, you know, maybe picking up the shopping, having to run into the city for an hour, or then pick up an elderly relative, or, you know, take their kids out to buy school clothes and all these other different things. And so what was happening was the city wasn't catering for everybody. It was catering for a very thin slice of the population. And Vienna has been looking at planning their city in much more inclusive ways for about the past 10 years. And the conversation, I think, is starting to propagate around the world. We're starting to understand what it means to make a livable city is to actually create a city that includes many, many more people and is active at all times of day. And so in this really interesting moment too, where we're really trying to understand the relationship between public and private, and what good public citizenship is and what good private citizenship is. So we're at this moment where we really need to look about these things and think hard about these things and think hard about how we want our cities to kind of be shaped and what we want them to look like and who we want them, who we are making them for. You know, when I worked in a more traditional manner as an architect making buildings, you know, you'd comply with the codes and you'd think that the codes, I just never thought that the codes didn't sort everything out in a lot of ways. You know, you're like, okay, if I make this big enough so that you can turn a wheelchair around, or if I put the tactile indicators in the right space, that's the way the world works. And architecture is incredibly complex, so obviously you need those kind of guidelines. But when you start to work in a more directly connected way, I suppose, with people who actually need to use the city in these different ways, you start to understand that it's way more complex than you had ever thought. One of the women we had on one of the tours last year, the New Academic Street tour last year, Anna, she uses a guide dog to get around the city, and she actually has low vision. And she was talking about how she might guide herself around the New Academic Street. On the tour, it was really interesting. She was talking about the lighting and the contrast. But she was also saying that for her type of low vision, the lighting was great to use as a guide. But for somebody else with a different type of low vision, it would actually be too glary and it would be an impairment. So you actually start to realise that it's very hard to design in one specific way that will solve everybody's problems. For me, I think it's really important to try to gain more empathy and understanding of the different kinds of problems you might come across, and then maybe try to design flexibly or design in ways where, you know, you can use multiple things, or there are kind of different layers of different kind of things in spaces that will help with accessibility and inclusion.
But you're probably not going to be able to solve it all in the one space. And, you know, dealing with codes and regulations and then heritage issues adds a whole other level of complexity. Anyone in a wheelchair or a pram or any kind of walking issue, because there's stairs everywhere. So how do you actually design these buildings and adapt them to be more inclusive and also maintain their beautiful heritage qualities is a big challenge. And people with disabilities are just one sector of the community. I mean, when you think about being female, walking around at night, there's violence, there's our trans community, people who live in the country who come to the city and find it incredibly confronting and intimidating because it's so loud and busy. There's many, many communities who are really excluded and finding our cities difficult places. I think just being more attuned to different communities, different needs, then we can have lots of different kinds of spaces, which I think would only add to our city and bring another layer of richness to it. Even in new buildings, we can tick all the boxes and think about, and I'm thinking of a conversation I had recently with Simona Castricum, an architect and a trans woman who pointed out to me, and I think the RMIT, the New Academic Street, there is a gender-neutral toilet facility. However, it's located in a sort of obscure place within the building. So I think location is really important, and it's not just about being empathetic to different communities, but also making sure that we make these spaces, you know, in a very central location. And
well, that goes back to the rights of the city question, doesn't it? So maybe when we think about the rights of the city, the first thing that we need to think about is the fact that everybody has the right to access the city with dignity. You know, so sometimes it's complicated, but nobody should be made to feel like a second-class citizen for being in the city. And so maybe dignity and respect, I think, are probably key tenets in there somewhere. We all need to think more about what the rights of the city are, because obviously it's, for me, it's like public space. So public space is defined culturally and it's socially produced. So buildings and the spaces that it's in might support it, but it's the things that happen, it's the events that take place, it's the social interaction that actually creates it. And If you think about, say, what Trafalgar Square is like, or Fed Square, or Tiananmen Square, or Times Square, these are all very, very different examples of public space. And so they're culturally defined, and they have cultural values embedded in them. And I think the rights to the city are a similar thing. Like, how do we see, what do Australians want to see as their rights to the city? How do we want to define our rights? And to define these rights, we have to take part in conversations about defining them, because these things are always negotiated territory. And then those rights to the city then start to express your cultural values, or vice versa. So, you know, if there's a problem, it's important to take part in the conversation around it so you can help to shape it.
Thank you to Tanya and Christine for their time, and everyone who came along to Urban Tactility.
Artist, advocate and activist Janice Florence was a featured panellist at the Rights to the City Talk as part of Urban Tactility. Janice works at Arts Access Victoria, runs Weave Movement Theatre and serves on City of Melbourne's Disability Advisory Committee. Just a couple of things.
Janice has an incredible story. She's spent many years advocating for better design, opportunities and outcomes for people with disabilities. She is a champion for the social model of disability, a vital reframing of how society thinks about and responds to disability. She joined us at the SB and explained what the social model is and how it's different to what came before.
Well, we talk about before that came the medical model, and the medical model is still very much in evidence, where the focus is on the individual and their condition. And that sort of goes with a charitable model where, you know, the poor people, we'll help them where we can. So there's no sort of social responsibility to do anything about that person's condition except if you feel sorry for them. But the social model says, no, it's not the person's condition that disables them. It's the society that they live in that disables them by having these buildings they can't get into, or this transport that they can't use, or this lecture they can't go to because they can't hear it and they can't have it Auslan signed to them, or this place they can't get to because they're blind or low vision and they don't have any tactile surface indicators to help them find their way. So the social model says that all those things have to be changed in order to make society accessible, and that they're the barriers that are getting in people's way, not their condition. It's a real change of view. Often that's the big thing that really affects people, telling people about the social model. Doors open for them. You know, it's a whole new way of looking at things. My name's Janice Florence, and currently I work part-time at Arts Access Victoria, which is a peak disability arts organisation, and my job there is to advocate within the arts industry for better access for people with a wide range of disabilities. So that can be physical, learning disabilities, sensory, cognitive. And then in my other time, I am the artistic director of Weave Movement Theatre, which is a physical theatre company with a majority of performers with a range of disabilities. I started off studying arts, and I always been interested in dance and theatre, and I was involved in a left-wing theatre group that was famous at the time called New Theatre. And I was in quite a few plays, but I sort of decided my body wasn't performing. You know, the words were coming out, but my body wasn't in it. So I did a graduate diploma of movement and dance. I lived in San Francisco for a year. I did a course with a woman called Anna Halperin, who's kind of known in the sort of alternative experimental dance world. And when I came back soon after that, I had a falling accident, which was kind of dance-related because I'd done this trapeze dancing, which isn't like trapeze but different to that. And I fell off a bar that I was hanging on and broke my back and got a spinal cord injury. So I landed up in a wheelchair, and then I started developing my own dance because I just wanted to keep dancing. And because I'd been doing fairly open dance forms, I was able to adjust and adapt. And for 10 years, I was part of a little dance company called State of Flux with four dancers who didn't have disabilities. We were based around a form called contact improvisation. But we experimented a lot with how you could perform with that and how you could teach it and how you could research it. A lot of people with disabilities at that stage in America were playing around with contact improvisation. And we brought a few teachers out from America during that time. then I was asked to teach a series of workshops by Arts Access Victoria, who I didn't work with at that time. And those people wanted to stay on together, so that became the Weave Company. And that's 21 years ago. So it's been running for 21 years. I've moved into sort of disability advocacy at that stage and worked a lot with physical access. I worked in a spinal cord injury association for a long time. And then I got the job at Arts Access, so that brought my interest together with disability advocacy and the arts. I was already working in advocacy and disability. I worked in public transport advocacy and a lot with trying to change building regulations, especially for private houses, which is still going on. It never came to anything because a lot of people involved in building fight against it because they think, you know, your home is your castle sort of thing, and no one should say how your house is, you know, whether the doors are wider. And if the doors are wider and things are a bit bigger in the bathroom, that's going to cost them more. So
it's a really interesting point around building regulation within the private residence because obviously within multi-residential development and in commercial buildings and civic buildings, there are standards to work to, and they're not watertight or they're not the best that they could be, but there's at least there's that baseline. But actually you're right that to think on the fact that the private residence has no building reg in the sense of access that we have to work to in terms of new build.
Yes.
So you've spent some time trying to push against that.
Yes, and it's very difficult for people with disabilities to find an accessible house. And also talking about the ageing population and how people after 65, the percentage of people with disabilities really increases because people acquire disabilities after the age of 65. And so, you know, they're building, someone called it Peter Pan housing, that doesn't really go with people who are ageing.
And that really limits the search because it's actually, especially now with all the extensions going on to our older heritage properties, finding a single level home in the inner Melbourne is a really difficult challenge.
I also, you know, have a bit of a thing about heritage, and even though heritage isn't very kind to access sometimes, I feel very sad to see a lot of places knocked down.
Picking up on that topic of heritage, you spoke when we had the urban tactility talk, you did talk about the administration that goes with managing your access requirements wherever you go and how complex it is. And I think heritage buildings, especially public heritage buildings, it's a real challenge. And recently we worked with Old Treasury to install a ramp through the front door for open house as a bit of a pilot in terms of how could we help through our programming some of these buildings change access so it's not round the back through a back door, calling somebody, as you had described. Would you be able to sort of just talk about that and how that impacts your life?
There's a whole thing where people think, oh, we can't do access because of heritage. But people have come up with creative solutions without wrecking the look of the building and the heritage value of the building. And one of those, I think, is at the Botanical Gardens, you know, the herbarium. There's a big ramp around the back of it. It's sort of circular. It goes with the shape of the building, and I don't think it disturbs the look of the building at all. But I think often people say, oh, no, we can't do anything because of the heritage. But you can actually do something. I had a little study tour to North America in the early 2000s, and I was staying at the University of Washington in Seattle, and that's the same vintage as Melbourne University. And that because they're so much more active advocates in America and people take more notice of them, all of the buildings really have been made accessible in one way or another. You know, some solutions mightn't be as satisfactory as others, like, you know, sort of precarious lift going up a couple of flights of stairs, the ones that hang onto a banister sort of thing. But on the whole, I could get around everywhere in that university. So I kind of think where there's a will, there's a way, and you don't have to ruin the look of it at all.
Why do you think in America that they have a kind of stronger voice and people pay more attention? Why do you think that is?
I think some places are more progressive than others. Like this was Seattle, and that's a fairly progressive place. The civil rights movement, you know, started in America, and the disability rights movement became part of that civil rights movement. And then the Vietnam veterans, a lot of them came back with disabilities, and they became quite a strong voice, advocacy voice for access. I mean, some things in America are good and some things are bad, and I think physical access is reasonably good in places I've been to anyway. I've been to Seattle a few times because there's a woman there who has a dance style that I was interested in for quite a long time, and I had a totally different feeling there. It was not long after my accident, and I sort of thought, oh, I feel really different. What is it? And so what I felt was kind of back to normal, because I could go anywhere without thinking about it too much and doing a lot of planning. And I could know that this little cafe down the road would be accessible and that I could go to the toilet there. Whereas that's still quite, you know, not so common here. And the buses in Seattle have been, which is their main form of public transport, have been accessible for a long time. And so if you can't get up a hill, you can always get on a bus.
Yeah, right. Okay. Oh, go Seattle. And removing those barriers, all it does is make it more accessible.
We talk about universal access, and really that applies to people as they're ageing. We've got the ageing population, and it applies to mothers with pushers and little kids. Really, it makes it more accessible for everybody. And, you know, who said at some stage that this group in the population were allowed to freely go to shows or lectures and hear them and see them, but this other group aren't allowed to do that? You know, I mean, it's an obvious human rights issue, but somehow people have a bit of a blind spot about it. You know, so it's been like this for so long that they just sort of think, they don't think, oh, it shouldn't be like that if it wasn't like that, because there still is a lot of the medical model attitude towards people.
Could we talk about the work that you're doing with the City of Melbourne through the Disability Advisory Committee, and also what you think, where we're succeeding in the city and perhaps where we're failing, mm-hmm. and what the city's trying to do to address some of those failures, mm-hmm. and especially as the city scales up and there's changes happening through construction on a daily basis, yeah, how your thoughts on how the city's coping?
Well, I think people tend to get a bit focused on wheelchair access. And so I do like to just remind people that there is lots of types of access. There's deaf access, there's blind access. And there are some advances happening with those things. I think they're having these little points around the city that people can tune into with phone apps people who are blind to find their way. But also with all the construction going on, there have been a lot of complaints within the Disability Advisory Committee at the City of Melbourne about construction companies not really setting up properly so that people can get through the sort of narrow footpaths or the ones that they create onto the road. So the ramps are too scarily steep to go down, really. Yeah, and we try to persuade, through the advisory committee, the council to police it more. So I think the good things are, right in the central city, the infrastructure around pavements and things is reasonably good now. But as soon as you get away from the centre, it starts to become less good. You know, you find really steep ramps that are hard to get up and down. And I know that access for people who are blind, it's a bit of a nightmare, really. You know, like, there are tactile surface indicators in some places, but things change. There is some research done by the City of Melbourne. I saw a film about it, and one woman was saying that just on that corner of Flinders Street and Swanson Street, there used to be a McDonald's, and she would always smell the McDonald's, and that was her way of knowing she was in the right place. But that's all been knocked down now, and so now she has to kind of readjust and somehow find her way another way. And the platform stops around the city, the public transport, that's improved. But then, you know, the number of accessible trams is very slow to change, and they estimate that it won't be finished till 2030. So the platform stops around the city are fine, but the thing is that when you get out into the suburbs, you might get on a tram, but you can't get off it near your house.
Yeah, it's the consistency that you really need that can enable all of those journeys.
The trains are the best public transport, means, you know, the most accessible form of public transport. And most buses now are accessible, but bus stops are at all different levels, so sometimes the ramps come down and there's quite a steep incline to get down.
And you did talk about that too at the Urban Tactility talk around the detail in the access. And so I think we're talking about the Kathleen Syme Library in Carlton through the City of Melbourne.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And how there is the parking out the front and there's a great ramp out the front, but it's actually that small detail of getting from the street to the pavement.
The building itself is fantastic, but if you park out the front and want to get up the curb, it's almost impossible.
Mm. I think you mentioned that you would drive around the corner and find a different park.
Well, I'd probably find a park near a driveway because the driveway would be easier than the curb to get up.
Yeah.
Kathleen Syme, you know, they provide such cheap hire of rooms. So it's all fantastic in the building. If you hire a room there and you're a not-for-profit, it's so cheap, you know, and that's another form of access, costs of everything. Australia has a really low rate of employment for people with disabilities in OECD countries compared, you know, we're about 27th or something, and a low rate of higher education and a high rate of poverty in disability. So people with disabilities, the cost of things is often prohibitive, is another barrier that they face.
Can we get quite specific, I guess, in that idea of what changes to spaces and accessibility might kind of look like, thinking about your role at Arts Access? Can you talk a little bit about how the design of somewhere like an arts venue or arts venues, performance spaces, can invite or be barriers to access, and what really great art spaces look like, both for artists and audiences?
Well, as the obvious things of flat entrances, automatic doors, or doors that are really light to open, accessible toilet facilities, choice of seating. Often you don't get a choice of seating. If you're in a wheelchair, you have to sit up the back where the spaces are. So they have done actually quite well in Hamer Hall, in the renovation of Hamer Hall. They've provided quite a choice of seating. But then there's all sorts of customer service things that arise, like someone in a high wheelchair sitting in front of someone who is sitting on an ordinary theatre seat. And, I mean, that all has to be thought about as well in advance. You know, how's that going to work? And then there's other people with other mobility needs, like being able to sit in an aisle chair so they can get out easily. So good access to aisle seating. And there are other needs, say, for people on the autism spectrum, maybe to get out quickly. So just seating that allows for that. And for people on the autism spectrum or with certain mental health issues, a quiet room is really good, a quiet space where people can retreat to. With box office counters at a height that you can operate with for short stature people or people in wheelchairs. So then there's needs for artists with disabilities. Because we're regarded as people who'll only be in the audience, you know, we couldn't possibly be performing on the stage. And I've performed on numbers of stages that you've had to go through the loading bay, or you've had to be lifted onto the stage, that's often not considered.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking of most, actually, the back of house area, because for those listeners who haven't been back of house in a theatre before, it's not as glamorous as the front of house area. It can be quite a drastic change when you walk through the sliding doors between front of house and back of house, and it can, in some arts venues, be a bit of a rabbit warren. Think the Muppets, actually. It's like kind of these kooky little, especially the older theatres, like can be tiny narrow stairs. And
well, I've been to the backstage of the Melbourne Recital Centre, and access there is generally pretty good.
Going back to your work with Weave Movement and your long career working in dance and movement and the arts, we're interested in your opinion around the importance of creativity and the arts, particularly public art, as being a catalyst for change, especially within the space around access and inclusion.
Yeah, I think arts is a different way of coming at it, and seeing artists with disabilities and their work is another way of changing that. What I think Graeme Innes, the former Disability Human Rights Commissioner, called the soft discrimination of low expectation. People do have really low expectations of people with disabilities, and you meet those attitudes every day, really. And to see people doing good art, you know, of various kinds, is a great way of awakening people. We talk about creative access at Arts Access to work the access into the artwork. So the expression of the artist is influenced by their life experience And so that can also be incorporated into performances, not necessarily as a theme, because I get a bit sick of people thinking the theme always has to be disability, but people with disabilities are multi-dimensional people and they might want to do performances about anything at all, but just seeing people performing and their way of performing helps to increase understanding while just having the connection that art creates, which is different from the more prosaic sort of explaining that you should acknowledge people's human rights. It's a good way of opening people's eyes in a new sort of way.
That soft discrimination of low expectation is really interesting, especially when I think about that story that you told as part of the open tactility talk around how you had a second accident where you broke your leg through performance and a dance movement.
Well, I used to get out of the chair and roll around on the floor. When I was with that group, Contact Improvisation Group, there were three strong young men involved, and so they used to dump me out of the chair. And so, but because I was, Contact's got various techniques of knowing how to fall and all these expressions like softening into the floor and sort of knowing not to hit hard. So I hardly ever had a bruise. And so I used to do that and I'd roll onto them and somehow I'd get back into the chair. And I was still getting out onto the chair to get on the floor, and that's how it all happened. Because you don't put weight through your bones for many years, the bones get more brittle. So probably I was getting to that stage as well. But anyway, look, it hasn't stopped me. But I'm still in the physical theatre company, and we do a kind of mixture of theatre and dance and movement and pedestrian movement, as we call it. I think art's a great way of connecting and bringing, you know, like Auslan interpreting right into the performance, which is now being done more.
That kind of shadowing.
Shadowing. Yeah.
It's so fantastic. It adds a whole other layer and dimension to the work. It's great.
And I guess it just brings it out into the world, you know, like people traditionally have been shut away. Mm. People with disabilities, you know, previously in institutions and still a bit in institutions. And so it just brings it out into the world, you know, where it makes us be part of the world. People are still quite scared and awkward around disability, I think, and afraid of doing the wrong thing and saying the wrong thing. So it often makes people hold back from interacting and having a closer relationship with people with disabilities.
A very big thank you to Janice Florence. That was such a great chat with her, wasn't it, Emma?
It was. It was pretty extraordinary. And we should mention, when it comes to disability activism and progress, Janice elaborated further on the differences between the USA and Australia after our chat. It was actually once the mics were off. She said that access measures in the US are stronger than Australia because citizens in the US more readily sue for discrimination. This is a direct quote from her. She said, "Their laws have more teeth. Discrimination actions are often diluted or discouraged by a weak, complaint-driven laws. Here it relies on disabled people to lodge complaints with all of the stress and possible expense that involves. The deregulation of the building sector means that the regulations are often not enforced if they are infringed. I think it's important people are aware of this." So thank you, Janice. Such a great addition to our conversation, and great that you followed up with us. It certainly gives us something to think about.
Why should better outcomes in cities be driven by complaints? That's the whole access labour idea again, putting it on the people who are already doing all the work.
And that's a great compliment to the point Tanya and Christine made about the codes and regulation, and how even though they may provide some basis from which to work from, there is the nuance that comes from working with real people, and nothing can beat lived experience and developing empathy.
So next time you're walking through your city, think about who it invites in and who it excludes, and how this is reinforced through clever or through questionable design. Fights for the right to the city are happening all around us, and they happen every day. You've been listening to The Rights to the City, episode 4 of This is Public, a podcast series produced by Open House Melbourne,
an independent organisation that fosters public appreciation for architecture and public engagement in conversations about the future of our cities.
This is Public episodes will be released every 2 months, give or take. Learn more, including where and how to listen, at openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic.
A deep thank you to presenting partner Metro Tunnel Creative Program and supporting partner the SB, who have brought This is Public to life, and to Open House Melbourne's generous donors, partners and supporters.
This Is Public is hosted and produced by us, Emma Telfer and Sally McPhee, with support from Brianna Carroll and Victoria Bennett. Our music and sound design is by Dan West, and our audio editor is Chris Andrews.
We record at the SV Podcast Bar, Tweak and Twang Studio, Number Station Studios, and on location.
This Is Public is created on the ancestral lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
Thanks for listening.